The Man in Line, brought to you by netzeromatrix.com, the Isle of Man's main net zero progress website.
Today on Man in Line, we're looking at the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture, which ranges far and wide from the wildlife park through to road transport licensing, Office of Fair Trading. The Minister is Claire Barber. Steve Stanley is Interim Chief Executive. And you're on the phones on 66 13 60. Text, email, or you can even WhatsApp. Good afternoon, Claire Barber.
Good afternoon, Andy.
Good to see you. And Steve, good to see you as well.
Good afternoon.
Interim Chief Executive at the moment. How long you
been in interim? So, since the beginning of August this year.
Okay, it was Richard before, wasn't it?
There was a previous interim before me, Andrew Sidebottom, and then it was Richard.
Okay.
All before that, yes.
Okay. Been around government for how long, Steve?
Ooh, I think it's getting on for 15 years, if not a couple of years more than that.
So you know your way around.
I should hope so by now.
Okay. Claire Barber, one of the first things just come up really in the past couple of days, rogue traders, Office of Fair Trading, getting their eyes on rogue traders. How much do you know about that?
So the Office of Fair Trading is a bit of an interesting sort of setup because it doesn't sit in DEFA. So we have an agreement with them where we would support in terms of memorandum of understanding with Office of Fair Trading, but they are essentially an autonomous body and they have the ability to go off and create their own policy and decide what they're looking at. But I mean, rogue traders, I think, is something that gets a lot of coverage, also from the police. We know that it's been something that has definitely increased, and most particularly, I think, since the internet and various other apps have just made it almost too easy. And there are definitely a number of people that, from a constituency basis, that I've supported who've been the victim of rogue traders, both door to door, in the sort of, I suppose, traditional manner that we know of it, but also a lot where it's been an online approach.
So, see, how does the department mesh then with OFT if it's autonomous or semi-autonomous? What's the interaction?
So we have an MOU, as the minister mentioned. So that sets out the sort of service level between the department as a sort of sponsoring department, and then the OFT as the sort of arm's length body. So we provide the sort of stationed office for the staff that that support the body, and so we have a close link in that way. But as the minister said, they are an arm's length body that conducts its business
okay
independently.
All right. Yeah. First on the line, we've got Julian, who's with us on Man in Line. Hi, Julian. You're with the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture.
Hi, Andy. I've got a couple of questions, so I'll do them quickly, and because I know there's other people who want to be on. Hi, Claire.
Hi there.
First question is, what is the current staffing structure at the meat plant, for example, the staff responsibilities?
I think to go into all of the staffing at the meat plant would probably take up the whole hour. But we would have ordinarily plant manager and financial and controller at the top. And some of this is laid out actually in the Burnie report that you can access online, both the current structure and some suggestions of future structure. There's then a series of sort of middle managers, I suppose you would call, around procurement, around some of the operations detail. And then there's the people who are on the slaughter line, in the boning hall, in the retail packaging, and all of the other bits that go with a meat plant, which are extensive.
Yeah. The reason I ask is because I think I've heard you say that you're talking about giving extra money to the meat plant. But wouldn't it be wiser to look at the origin of the problems that the meat plant had, which really started around 2014 when the cooperative trading model was ditched? Because otherwise, you might be throwing good money after bad.
Yeah, so I don't think I've said I want to give more money to the meat plant. The long-term goal is to reduce the subvention for the meat plant, and I think there are a number of opportunities that exist with that. Some of them are ones that I've talked to a lot of farmers and a lot of people who've been involved with the meat plant, and these aren't new ideas, but what we do have with the recent audit report is a very clear document that explains how and why we would seek to make those changes and give some of that evidence background. We still do have the Fat Stock Marketing Association as the other shareholder of the plant with DEFA, and their input is really valuable because they do provide that sort of cooperative knowledge, that corporate memory, and I think that's really valuable. So I think the point you make is right. Actually, it's not about just throwing money at something. It's about saying, how do we make sure the future structure of this is fit for purpose so that it's achieving the end goal, which is providing a very important service for the agriculture sector, but also making sure that we have really good routes to market locally for our meat, which is of such good quality. So I think there's a number of things that we need to make sure we're working on. We need to make sure the sales model's right, and that's something that's flagged very strongly, and something that will need addressing.
Yeah. Final question. The meetings recently of the G20 and the B20 recently talked of the One Health Initiative, where they're talking about centralising all agricultural production into a few super blocks around the world. And Klaus Schwab, the founder of the World Economic Forum, referred to it as blockisation. Just wondered, are you receiving any advice from off-island, or are you more supportive of a self-sufficient, sustainable agricultural production capability on the island? So no matter what happens across, we've got the ability to, you know, have our own eggs. You know, if the boat didn't go for a month, would we be okay? Would we be able to produce our own bread, eggs, meat?
And I think there's a number of pieces to that comment you made. So we do have links in through our offices with offices in other jurisdictions, and I think that's important. But I think the point you make around self-sufficiency is also really pertinent, certainly across agriculture sector and food security. What we do see is, we do, as you say, we have eggs, we do have red meat across three different species on the islands. So we've got the pork, the lamb, the beef. We also then have arable crop, as well as a plethora of other parts of our food production on island. And it's absolutely right that we look to support that. So I don't think, I would be very nervous around us moving towards a reliance on other big organisations. And the other thing is that as we move towards looking at climate change and the agriculture sector in partnership with MNFU, with the producers, I think it's also important to recognise that the real high-level production is often actually not as good for the environment as what we have on the island, which is farmers who have got an absolute investment in our countryside, in our biodiversity, and in the future of this island. And it's really important we tell that story. So I think it's important that we're having conversations with external bodies and other jurisdictions, but I also think that does not mean we take our eye off the ball in terms of that self-sufficiency. And I suppose as a caveat, I would say I don't believe we'll be self-sufficient in its entirety. But as you say, one of the things that we absolutely need to understand is that short term, if there was an issue where we couldn't access food in a short period of time, could we quite quickly change some of our production, keep things on island, and make sure that we could provide to people who are here in the short term? And we do have a piece of work that's ongoing at the moment as well, with an external consultant who've got access to a lot of those different ideas that are being floated elsewhere, and allowing some of that to be consolidated, but also to talk with the sector and to do that in a neutral way, I suppose, to make sure that we're hearing and capturing all of the voices. So that's ongoing at the minute, and that's specifically looking at food security for the Isle of Man, and also how that ties in and underpins our agricultural strategy.
Might it be worth encouraging chicken growing facilities on the island so that we get back the ability to have proper Manx chicken in that case? Because that was the one that was missing off your list of what we can do on the island.
Yeah, so at the minute we don't have poultry producers for meat. We have poultry producers for eggs. And that, that's something, if someone wants to come and look in how they can expand into that market as a department, we'd absolutely support people to move into that. And it'll be interesting to see whether there are gaps that are identified out of the ongoing work that's happening just at the moment in terms of those obvious areas that potentially we should be absolutely looking at. So it's one of those areas that does come up frequently.
Okay.
Oh, thanks, Claire.
All right, appreciate that.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Julian. A note in from Trevor who just said, where's the DEFA chief executive? He's here. He's here. Steve is here. And it's good of Steve to come up. Ash Dieback says, Pete, what action's being taken to control Ash Dieback? Reported an affected tree, but no action was taken. Whereabouts was that, Pete? And we talked about Ash Dieback last time, Claire Barber, and I think you said it's more down to controlling it. You're never going to get rid of it.
Yeah, Ash Dieback's been a huge issue, and it's we know that there are a significant number of cases on the island. The reality is that we aren't at the minute in a position where we're able to proactively go out and manage all of that. And that is essentially comes down to budget, comes down to personnel. But there is ongoing work within the forestry's team to both manage that as best as we can at the moment, but also look at a longer term plan. But all of that would require us to go and get additional support. Some of that may be able to be supported through some of the initiatives that talk about tree planting as well, because actually if we manage the forest trees well and remove dead trees and replace them with new young trees, actually that's a positive news story. But all of that is going to take a significant piece of work when we look at the extent, not just of ash dieback, but of other tree diseases that we have. Dutch elm disease, Phytophthora ramorum, we know that there are significant challenges in this area.
What state are the plantations in? Are they healthy?
It's quite mixed. So I spent some time recently with officers. We did have a chance to go round some of the plantations to look at some of the trees and some of the tree disease. And actually, once you start to know what you're looking for, I suppose it's... I remember Charles Gard did something around architecture where he always said, just look up. And I thought that was fascinating when you stop and look up. Same with trees. When you stop and start looking up, you start to realise where some of those challenges are. But there's no question that some of our plantations do have challenges around tree diseases.
A message in now, another one regarding rogue traders, an action taken against rogue traders. And this correspondent, 916, is talking about unlawful cannabis clinics. There appear to be lots of stories on social media on the island, and indicating money's been taken from the pockets of the vulnerable, the sick, and promises of prescriptions for cannabis only for the clinic to disappear with their money.
So if people have examples of that, I would absolutely encourage them to feed those in, both to Office of Fair Trading, but also to the Department of Health and Social Care. But if they want to use me as a conduit for that, obviously more than happy to feed those to the right places. Both there's two elements. One is around that rogue trading element. The other is around, we do have regulation and criteria that are in place for clinics, and that sits under the Regulation of Care Act. Not only is there work we already have in place, but there's also a piece of work about how we can refresh that piece of legislation that's happening through DHSC at the moment. So any information that people do have, would always encourage them to not just post on social media, although I accept people do that, wanting to make sure other people avoid falling into those same traps. But equally, it would be really helpful if those are fed in through the formal channels and we can address them.
Okay, a message in now. This is from Frida. Hello, Frida. Just say, could you ask Steve what part the civil service, the bureaucrats, she called you, I'm sorry about that, played in the meat plant report?
So the meat plant report was an independent report. So we contracted with a consultant through a procurement process to get sort of industry experts to come and do that review. Clearly, where there was information required to assist with that review, then that was provided through the department or other individuals as required. So it was very much an independent review. And then obviously that report was received by the department, and you'll have seen it, that's been published.
And Claire Barber again, everybody's going on about the meat plant, so we're going to have to talk about it again. I don't want to mix my metaphors, but it appears it's a bit of a dog's breakfast, and it appears you've got it on your plate and you're going to have to sort out the meat plant. Is there a solution to this? Because it just seems that some of the problems seem to be intractable.
So I think what's clear is that the audit report highlights some real areas of opportunity for the meat plant. And that's been absolutely where the focus is for our sort of short to medium term, but also looking at how we can resolve the backlog on the farms that we have at the moment, and equally how we can make sure that any of the areas around identified around things like working at Hyatt, we're comfortable that those are resolved. And actually having talked with the team in the plant, a lot of those things are in place. They've been resolved, or they were already actually in place. It just wasn't able to be laid the hands on. So there's a number of things already happening at the plant. But as you say, it is on my plate. But I would reiterate, as I have done a number of times, that is very much a short-term position. Yeah. It's not, for me, my opinion is, and hasn't changed, that it's not for politicians to run the meat plant. This was an immediate response to a specific outcome of a report. I've put myself in as the chair role, but I would be the plan is, and we've got an advert drawn up that's going through the relevant processes to go out and look for a chair for the board.
And would that chair be from the Isle of Man, or would you be sourcing it from across?
I suppose, as with any job, if there's someone with the skill set we're looking for on the island, that would be given a priority. But if there is a need to look elsewhere for that level of speciality and knowledge, then we would certainly be open to that. But I think there is a certain degree of that knowledge around red meat that's talked about in the report that absolutely we should be trying to capture.
OK, on the phones now, Juan's with us. Hi, Juan, you're live with DEFA.
Hey, good afternoon, Andy. Good afternoon, Claire.
Hi, Juan.
Hi. Okay, got a few questions for you. Just listening to Julian there before and the points that he was bringing up. I get a bit perplexed about the state of the meat plant and how it's been let get to this stage. In any normal business, this would have been identified a long time ago. And I wonder why we have to issue reports or get reports done costing money when the problems there should have been identified a long time ago. One of the points I'd like to, or the question I'd like to ask is, what is the will of government to support the growth of cattle, dairy farming, arable farming here on the island? I know there is support for farmers, per se, and also for Green Fields Initiative, but going on again with the structure that seems to be happening and the problems that is happening in the Netherlands, and you did touch on climate change and biodiversity very briefly there, but it is very concerning what's happening in other places with this craziness of trying to reduce cattle, etc. So I'm wondering what your take is on that, and also the will of government to support the growth of this market, because I think, as you've said, we have a very, very good quality product, as we have with our flour. Yeah. And I think we'd be missing a trick if we didn't support that and grow it, despite what's happening in other world climates.
Yes, Juan, I'd certainly agree with you. I think in terms of the meat plant specifically, one of the challenges was around KPIs being put in place. That's something we need to resolve. That hadn't been the case.
KPI meaning?
Key performance indicators. So it's one of those buzzwords that prior to being in government, I think I hated, but maybe I need to think of a new word, although then that would be confusing in meetings. But no, putting performance metrics, essentially, having things that we can say, that's what we need to achieve. Have we achieved it? What do we need to do to achieve it? Those things hadn't been there, and it's absolutely imperative that they are in place. And that then helps both the shareholders, so both DEFA, but also the Fat Stock Marketing Association, who are the other shareholder, in terms of them seeing that the plant's delivering what it needs to. In terms of growth of the industry, actually, what's really exciting is that the audit report on the meat plant, looking at one specific industry, talks very much about the growth and actually saying that once we get this meat plant to a position where we're maximising the sales margin and we've got the skills and competence within the plant by providing really good regular training for our staff, we'll be able to grow that industry. And I think that's a really exciting prospect for the island. And actually, I agree, Drew, and I think there are opportunities across other sectors in agriculture to look at where we can grow. And that ties in with food security. I think one of the big pieces of work that is already being talked about at length through the union, through producers I'm talking to, and through the climate change team, is that ability to properly understand what the current emissions look like within agriculture, but also the benefit that agriculture brings in terms of good land management and biodiversity and those other tangible benefits that tie into the climate change picture. So it isn't just a net emitter. And also the emissions are methane driven as opposed to carbon driven, and that makes a significant change over the time period that those emissions take to disappear and not be causing damage anymore. And I also say that that's one of the pieces of work that is being looked at across the agriculture strategy and how that ties in. So I think you make a really good point, but certainly I can talk for myself that I'm absolutely committed, and I know that I'm not alone on that, certainly within government or parliament. But ultimately, until we have something in terms of a proposal that we put to either government or parliament, I can't test that in detail or make a guarantee of where support is for other people.
Okay, all right, June.
Yeah, and just a quick one before you cut me off, Andy. The net zero and the climate change thing seems to be the big keywords, the buzzwords that's going on. And I think we've got to remember that, I mean, these reports are probably in the last 100 years. What we do forget is how long this world has actually been going for. I mean, the Vikings came here in 900 and settled here for 300 odd years because of what we had here. And we shouldn't get rid of that. We should remember, we go back about our history and everything that's happened here and the people that wanted this island for their own. So we've got a uniqueness here, and I keep saying about this uniqueness, we shouldn't follow a lot of the stuff that's going on, because the world's been going on a lot longer than these people have been doing graphs for.
Okay.
There's hot and cold, and you know, let's keep what we've got and make it an affluent island and self-sustainable for us.
Okay.
For the difficulty coming
All
up.
Right.
Cheers, Andy.
All right, thanks for calling today. Just a quick one from Dave, and you may or may not be able to answer this. Could you ask the minister why livestock wasn't allowed in the meat plant this morning?
So I haven't spoken with the plant this morning as yet. So. I would advise anyone, though, if they've got queries, to contact the plant directly.
Question from to WhatsApper. Could you please let me have the minister's view on this? Well, I'll ask her. Regarding the production of marijuana on the Isle of Man, if marijuana were legalised on the Isle of Man, it would increase tourism, allow farmers to grow another crop, and it could increase the number of jobs at the airport as well, and the sea terminal security getting in and out of the Isle of Man. Where does DEFA stand on production of marijuana?
So DEFA's role within this is predominantly a regulatory one, as it would be a deemed, I assume, an agricultural crop.
No policy input.
So we wouldn't, at the minute, have policy input. From a personal perspective, I've obviously spoken previously about us being able to have a better understanding around decriminalisation and where the options lie in that regard. I definitely don't think we should be going down it being a criminal route. I think it should be far more about support and education for people where they're using marijuana. And I know a number of people who do use that for medical purposes. Obviously, there has been a shift in policy now, where there are the ability to go to get unlicensed marijuana products, cannabis products, through private prescription. But I also know that isn't going to be what some people are looking for, where they're looking for the ability to grow their own plants and so on. But DEFA don't hold a policy on that.
Okay, and quickly, if you would, when will government departments start using Manx meat for schools, hospitals and care homes? All on-island usage would benefit the profitability of the meat plant. The public should think about what happens if the boat doesn't sail and use Manx products 52 weeks of the year. Can government departments mandate other departments to use Manx meat?
So government departments can't mandate other departments. However, what is happening is a piece of work that's happening within my food team in DEFA, exploring how it originally came around that there isn't a preference around using Manx produce. That piece of work's ongoing. They're working with the procurement teams and looking at where the barriers lie and what can be changed to make that work better. But the point's really important. Actually, if everyone tried to just change one additional item in their shopping basket each week to use a local product, we'd be on the right journey, I think.
Live with Claire Barber, the Minister. Steve Stanley is here, the Interim Chief Exec from DEFA on Man in Line.
Twinkle, twinkle, little lights. All this Christmas shining bright. decorations, gifts and trees, everything that you could need. Who's got Christmas just for you? Ramsey Garden Centre do. Walk through the Northern Lights into a land of ice and snow at Ramsey Garden Centre. Indoor and outdoor lights, a magical range of real and artificial trees, decorations, gifts and much more. Christmas at Ramsey Garden Centre, Albert Road. Concerned, confused or curious about climate change? Want to do your part? Then visit netzeromatrix.com, helping businesses and individuals understand the net zero targets that government has set, how they'll be achieved and what impact it will have upon us. Plus, get practical advice and tips for saving energy, the options available for switching to renewable energy technologies and much more. We all need to do what we can. So visit netzeromatrix.com and join us.
Just take a look at the menu at Port St. Mary Golf Pavilion. Lunch is served 7 days a week and there's so much choice. Whether you fancy a sandwich, a hearty meal or coffee and homemade cake. Port St. Mary Golf Pavilion is a hidden gem tucked away down at Callow Point, where every visitor will receive a warm welcome, superb quality and great value. For menus and opening times, visit their Facebook or click psmpavilion.im. Time for food, time to visit Port St. Mary Golf Pavilion.
Help us make a life-changing difference and enter our monthly hospice lottery draw. You could win one of three cash prizes of £1,000, £300 or £150 for just £5 per play. That means we can continue to provide our services to those who need them, when they need them, completely free of charge. Enter online at hospice.org.im/lottery. Players must be 16 or over and terms and conditions apply.
Do you have a passion and understanding of the role of public service media in our community? Are you well versed in the main issues and challenges facing broadcasters today? Do you have a clear understanding of the needs of the Isle of Man audience? We are seeking to appoint an additional trustee to sit on the new Manx Radio Board of Trustees together with the existing non-executive directors of the company. The candidate appointed is likely to have experience, skills and expertise that is relevant to the activities carried out by Manx Radio. If you would like to explore this opportunity further, please head to the Manx Radio website, click on About Us and then click on Vacancies. Good luck.
The Man in Line, brought to you by NetZeroMatrix.com, helping Isle of Man companies and citizens to understand net zero targets and a green future.
Live with Claire, Barbara and Steve Stanley from DEFA today. A quick one in. David S. says, could you ask why when you call HSE, it's an answer phone? People's lives could be at risk. Is it an answer phone?
I think it's just purely down to the volume of staff that we have in some of these teams, and they'll be out doing active assessments, so it's easier to operate an answer phone service and come back to them, but certainly it's something we can take away and look at if that's felt to be an issue.
Steve, obviously DEFA ranges far and wide, very many different disciplines. So how does a chief exec keep abreast of this? How many in your team?
So in the department there's over 200 individuals. And it is a really wide-ranging department. So from a bandwidth perspective, just sort of trying to keep a track of everything, it is challenging because it's, whilst we have over 200 people, there's lots of small teams with multiple functions. So that covers regulation, policy, a whole range of some quite unusual functions. So it is challenging. But we have an exec team, so the leaders of the organisation who have their teams, and the structure allows for communication throughout the department. And we're always looking how to do that better. We're always looking at a two-way conversation that we need to have with our people. And I'm really keen to make sure that we do that really.
And the public, I mean, callers to Man in Line are often fascinated and have their own opinions on relationships between chief execs and ministers.
Yes.
And does the tail wag the dog or the dog wag the tail? People are interested in the dynamics between a politician and a chief exec.
So in my view, it's very clear that the minister sets the policy and the direction, and my role is to execute that, to make sure the resources are available, to make sure there's a clarity around the direction that the team need to pull towards, and ultimately make the decision around prioritisation to ensure that we are ultimately delivering on what we're being asked to deliver. And that's really challenging, and that's something that I have huge respect for the team in terms of their ability to pivot, to move to different things that come up. I think the term that's been used this year in terms of the word that's been voted on as the word of the year is perma-crisis. And I think a lot of people would sort of recognise that as being a situation where it does seem to be one thing after another in terms of there was obviously Brexit and the work that came with that, COVID, as the, you know, the pandemic showed, a huge level of change and requirement to adjust and take action. Lots of movement around government to try and respond to that. And then obviously now with the war in Ukraine and the cost of living crisis, again, that's brought new challenges and new things that we need to prioritise. So absolutely, that's my clear understanding. I think that's absolutely how it works.
If the department needs more money, because obviously you have a budget, if the department needs more money, is it something you would flag up to the minister? Would you bring that up with Treasury or both of you? How does that work?
So I think there's various conversations that happen around that. So first of all, to identifying what the need is. So if a new priority comes in, for example, and that's often what we've seen of late, you know, something new that we haven't potentially had to deal with before comes in.
Or budgeted for.
We have to look at, first of all, we always look at what we can afford to do within our own budget envelope. So are there things that we could move back in terms of urgency and priority? Are there things that we could stop doing or do differently? And of course, those conversations we'll be having within the department with the minister and members as appropriate. And if there is a need to look for additional funding, there are some routes available within Treasury. But certainly, you know, budgets are very tight at the moment, and there's an absolute expectation that we will manage within our own budget framework. Yeah. But clearly, where there are things that can't be found within existing budgets, we'll have to make a case to Treasury to allow that funding to be released.
And give or take, what's the budget for DEFA?
So it's around about £20 million. We do generate some income in some of the services that we provide, but ultimately it's not cost recovery.
Does the sawmill generate money?
It does generate money, and it's a really interesting journey that we've been on with the sawmill. We are increasing income through a range of different ways in terms of product lines, making efficiencies, looking at how we can bring in equipment that will increase productivity. And I think there's a really strong journey that the sawmill is on to do more of that. Biomass fuel is produced within the sawmill. We service a number of buildings around the island in that with that fuel at the moment, but I think we can do a lot more, and certainly both from a cost of living perspective but also from an energy security perspective, I believe there's a lot more we could do within that area.
Okay, to the uninitiated, I mean, does the sawmill serve the public at all?
It does. So the model that we use, we do sell directly to the public, but primarily we try to use existing retailers. So around the island we have service level agreements where we sell to wholesalers, and that's predominantly where we make a lot of our sales, certainly to sort of retail customers. But obviously the agricultural sector is a big part of our customer base as well.
Okay. Claire Barber, here's a message in from Perry now regarding the mills, and Juan touched on the future of Laxey Glen Mills. What are we doing with the flour and the grain?
So at the moment there's enough grain in the silos for well over 2 years, which was what we would ordinarily expect to have. We are continuing to produce flour. I had an opportunity to go around with Stee, actually. We went up and saw the mill in action, just to understand it a little better. And the mill's slightly different because it actually is a Treasury owned company as the sole shareholder, but obviously it has a significant part to play in agriculture, and I think it would be fair to say that there do remain some challenges around how we support the milling wheat growers, and that's something that we need to pick up and we need to work with, and we've taken that feedback. We had a meeting just the other day where that was fed back to us, but actually, as you say, looking at where we can grow the flour market, where we can support the bakeries that we do have on the island, to look to either grow or to diversify what they're producing, and look at other companies on the island that do use flour as a raw ingredient, and where they could maybe move to using the local flour, but also, you know, potentially exploring some of the options around export. And there are some complexities to that. And
so we're not using anywhere near as much flour on the island as we used to, obviously, with Ramsey Bakery. So is the mill exporting across?
No, so not at present. So there are some additional challenges because there's additives put in flour that's used in the UK. So folic acid is added, for example. We don't do that here. So there are some things that would have to be looked at. And I know that the board of the mill are looking at all options at the moment.
Obviously, this year's harvest will have gone into the mill. I mean, is there enough space for next year's harvest?
So at the minute, the there has been a guarantee to purchase at the pre-agreed prices, or people can choose to export. We know that some have chosen to export or to sell as your feed grain as an alternative. So it's not ideal, but until we know what the future, I suppose, looks like, till we've got a longer term strategy piece put together for the mill, we can't commit. Or the mill, I'm saying we, it's not me, it's very much Treasury, but Treasury can't commit as the mill to just keep buying forever if there's nothing in terms of the ability to turn that into an end product and then have a set route to market.
Could you just explain that mechanism, that setup again, Treasury and DEFA regarding the mill? Who owns what?
So Treasury is the sole shareholder for the mill. And then there is a board of directors that they appoint who sit and make the strategic decisions for the mill. And then there's the staff who are working in there operating the mill. DEFA have a stakeholder, not a shareholder, I suppose that's the key, in terms of the role it plays in terms of that wider agriculture sector and agricultural strategy. So we have been engaged with that process. In fact, we've supported the commissioning of a report to look at the future and the options for the mill. But that report won't be owned by us because ultimately the decision won't sit with us.
Would you forgive any listener who got the jitters when we hear about the meat plant that has a cloud over it, let's just say a benevolent cloud, but a cloud over it, and the fact that Ramsay Bakery is no longer with us, and the mills are where they are, and Treasury is interested, and when Treasury is interested, they're up, the Treasury, by definition, are bean counters. Treasury is an accountancy function that looks at and likes to cut cost. Should people have the jitters about Laxey Glen Mills and the meat plant?
No, because I think that what Treasury also do is they work within a council of ministers to deliver a policy that is set for our island. So yes, they have a function which is to make sure that the books come together, but that could be said for every department function that we have, where ultimately, if you know, if we go, as Steve said before, we can go and ask for additional money for providing a service. What I would say is Treasury are looking at making how we work with them, and not just us but all the departments work with them, much more flexible, and I think that will be beneficial, and they're certainly taking that feedback that's come from Timbald members over, I think, a number of years, around how we can improve the budget processes more broadly. I think there is lots of work still to do on that, but I understand people's concerns. I'm not seeking to say that they're not valid, because I think we all have different concerns over different things, and the closer you are to something, the more real that is to you. But the reality is that we're already providing support to the mill. I've seen no sign of Treasury saying that they're about to say no. They're actively engaging, they're working with us, and we're looking at how the future looks and how that fits in with that wider agricultural piece.
Steve Stanley is the Interim Chief Exec of DEFA. Claire Barber, MHK, is the Minister for the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture on Man in Line today.
Are you a reluctant landlord? Tired of tenant hassles? Cursed by constant maintenance? Tormented by empty properties producing no rent? Want to escape these worries or get out altogether?
At Prime Lettings, we understand your pain and have bespoke solutions to release you from these problems. Ring us on 616 707 for a free confidential chat.
Prime Lettings. We're on call and on the ball at 616 707.
Just hop on board with Tours R Us.
Aboard for 2023 as the new Tours Isle of Man holiday brochure is out now. We've off-island tours across the British Isles and even an eight-day trip to the Netherlands, including half-board, comprehensive tour itinerary and door-to-door transporting comfort. To find out more and book, call 453 681 or visit tours.co.im.
That ready for Christmas feeling. It's when you know those special bottles for the main event have been carefully selected and stored. Buy now at ShopRite and WineRite, and you'll save a packet into the bargain. Like selected Sainsbury's Taste the Difference wines with a 25% discount. And multi-buy offers on a great range of wine and beer. Buy now and be sure you have it at ShopRite and WineRite. Proudly locally owned.
Do I tell you right now?
I think you've got one of those old...
Do I tell you right now?
Go on.
popping corn.
A tape machine. You're putting a tape in the cassette player and you're closing the door.
Do I tell you right now?
Manx Radio's Mystery Sound of Man with 1886.
There's 2.5 hours of this every weekday morning, 9:30 to 12. Or we do squeeze in some music and we do race horses. What's there not to like?
The Mark Tarley Morning Show, brought to you by Sure. The Man in Line, brought to you by netzeromatrix.com, helping Isle of Man companies and citizens to understand net zero targets and the green future.
Just a quick one, Claire Barber, and this was a constituency one, so just forgive me if I just bring this one in. One of Claire's mandates in her manifesto was affordable housing. Where do you stand on that at the moment? What's happened on affordable housing?
So we've got the Housing Communities Board that has been established as a Councillor Minister subcommittee, and equally there's work that fits under the economic strategy. So I think it's tying those two pieces together. Having affordable housing is essential for us around key workers. It's essential for us if we want to look to bring people in to fill some of the other roles that are outside of key workers, but still are, you know, pretty essential to the future of the island. So having affordable housing's, you know, critical, but it's also important that affordable housing is of a good quality.
Okay. I mean, obviously, affordable housing for nurses and for medical professionals, you know something about that. How do we make sure that we get enough nurses and medical professionals on the Isle of Man, particularly because there's a worldwide shortage?
And that's the key. There is a worldwide shortage. You know, from a personal point of view, I think there was some very strange choices made by the UK government of the time around changing the bursaries, changing the access to funding for your fees. So it was interesting. I was chatting to someone who has just recently qualified as a nurse. I should say they're a UK resident, so it's slightly different to the Isle of Man, although not significantly so. They've come out of university with a debt of £50,000 after doing 3 years of nurse training. That's including student loan and including their fees. When I came out of university as a student nurse, I was very fortunate to have been able to have a bursary as part of the deal. My fees were free. They were paid for me. And I came out of university having taken a small weekend job, which meant I could cover my accommodation costs. It's a significantly different situation the nurses are finding themselves in now. So I think that was an error that I think we are also struggling off the back of. But I think we will be, you know, we already are looking, it's fair to say, because I've had conversations with DHSC around this, about how we can support not just the on-island training, because I think on-island training is really important. And it's been great to see that grow over the years, the number of people who are part of our cohort each year doing both adult nursing and mental health nursing, but also looking at how we can support people from the island once those spaces are full to go and study nursing in the UK. And then with a guarantee that they come back. And I think that's probably the next piece of the jigsaw. But I'm going to say it's an imperfect situation, because what you don't want is a hospital full of newly qualified nurses. It's quite daunting, I can tell you, having been there. And you want to be working with nurses with a whole breadth of experience. And it's becoming harder and harder to attract nurses because there are, sadly, a lot who are leaving the profession.
OK, back to DEFA. Bonzo, you're live with the Interim Chief Exec and the Minister.
Well, hello, Andy, and hello, Claire, and hello, Steve. What are DEFA, or how much progress, should I say, has DEFA made on the enabling of offshore and onshore wind power generation?
So, again, it's a very small team in DEFA, and I would say that a number of the work streams have been diverted to assist with doing some of the work around cost of living crisis and energy efficiency, and that's something that we've flagged. It's something that has consistently been sitting as a red risk rating on our risk register in terms of delivery. So we've now worked a lot closer with the likes of DfE and DOI in terms of how we can seek to deliver that. There's been a lot of work with MUA, and that is, I believe, now looking at being set up almost as a separate project and programme delivery group.
What's your responsibility? What's the department's responsibility for onshore and offshore wind? Where does it fit in?
So the strategy sits in DEFA. So right. Energy strategy sits in DEFA.
Okay, Bonzo?
Well, I mean, energy strategy, but also I believe the regulatory issue between UK and Isle of Man, as goes access to the UK renewables market for Contract for Difference. As I recall, your new head of energy policy actually worked on these matters in the UK ministry, BEIS. So I would have thought that these things could be progressed at some pace, because these are things, especially with the offshore wind situation, where we see ourselves increasingly surrounded by wind turbines that are generating lots and lots of seabed leasing revenue for UK and Crown Estates. We will also see from Dublin the new array that's being built there. And we can see all this, and not a megawatt of it is Manx, and not a megawatt of it is producing a penny for the Manx exchequer, when you have things like the Morgan and Mona fields, which are leased for, what is it, £200 million a year for the next 10 years by Crown Estates. So we are missing out on large amounts of revenue, which the Manx exchequer urgently needs, and that needs to be processed as fast as possible.
Okay, Steve or Claire?
Yeah, so that was flagged in the economic policy as well. Economic strategy, sorry, I should say. That's one of the areas of opportunity, which is why there has been a piece of work to look at where the line should draw between DEFA and DFE. For that exact reason, the quicker we can prioritise that, the better we can see the benefits. And as Bonzo rightly says, we're coming to a position where you'll be looking out your window and seeing a whole array of wind farms, and we won't be getting the benefit from them. So it seems to make eminent sense to be able to look out the window and also see some that we are getting the benefit from.
But, I mean, the public would say, that we're over a year into this in the new House of Keys, and we've talked about this, and it seems to be falling between two departments. So there doesn't seem to be a hurry on.
But there is already a contract in place as well with Ørsted, so there is an opportunity there. They are actively increasing their presence on the island. The routes to market are looking much stronger. Some of the areas where previously Contracts for Differences were required, that's now actually a viable route without Contracts for Difference. Although we are still in discussion with counterparts around whether we can extend Contracts for Difference to the Isle of Man. So there is work ongoing. I suppose the point I'm flagging is when Steve says that the department's got, just over 200 people within it, and we're trying to deliver a huge plethora of work, when there is something that comes up that requires very urgent and quick response, we have no choice but to move people away from it. So the very small team that have been doing the energy bill is the same team who are doing the energy efficiency scheme and the cost of living work, and it's the same team working on the energy strategy. They're doing an inordinate amount of work, for which I'm hugely grateful, and I spend a huge amount of time in meetings as we talk about the direction and where those challenges are. But ultimately it is a small team, so that's why we are working with colleagues in DFE to make sure that where there are opportunities to transfer some of that work and to take the knowledge and experience they have, we're seeking to do that.
Okay, final word, Bonzo.
Well, as somebody who's worked in Whitehall, I mean, I think this this lack of pace really is not good enough. I think that these things can be done at pace if there is the will to do it. I don't think it's so much of a question of resources, and I think it's a question of interdepartmental inertia, which sadly was the case for 5 or 6 years before with DEFA under Bouton in the Quayle regime.
Okay, all right, we have to leave it there, but thanks for calling today, Bonzo, because we've not touched planning, Claire Barber. Obviously, planning and building control comes under you. Yeah. Where we are with brownfield sites and moving on. I mean, I don't know how much and how little you can say about planning, but there are notable disputes and conversations going on about brownfield sites around Douglas. Where does the department stand?
Just I'm going back very briefly to the statement around cross-government inertia. I would say that there are cross-government working groups on this, and I just want to pick that point up and give that confidence. This has been prioritised within the economic strategy. It's absolutely a topic of regular conversation, amongst ministers and amongst political members. I'm sure it's the same in the chief officer group. So I'd like to give that reassurance back to both Bonzo and all the other listeners. In terms of planning, there's actually a piece of work work that we've done, which I think will, well, I'm hopeful will be positive, which is to separate the member responsible for planning within DEFA from the person who is the chair of the planning committee. Because one of the bits of feedback we had when Mrs. Christian was, Claire Christian was in that role, was that that led to a conflict. It meant she wasn't able to drill down into anything in the department because it might well turn up at the planning committee. We're looking at how we can separate that off. So that's why David Ashford has taken the role of the chair, but hasn't taken the role of member of planning in DEFA, to keep him essentially sterile and trying to prevent some of those potential conflicts. But there's also a huge amount of work that's going on through the Brownfield Regeneration Steering Committees, and equally in terms of the other... The burp. It's called the burp group.
We're just about out of time. I've just got one quick yes or no question. And it's from Peter, who said, has Claire Barber been offered the DHSC ministerial role?
I haven't, no. I should just say burp program. It's built environment reform, but burp stuck in my head and I didn't want to say it, but we're there now anyway.
That's it. Thanks to Steve Stanley. Thanks for being with us today, Steve. Good to have you aboard. And also Claire Barber, MHK Minister at the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture. As usual, we've covered about 10% of what we wanted to talk about, so hopefully we'll see you in the new year.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, Andy.
All right. Merry Christmas to everybody at DEFA. And that's it. Stick around. 1 to 3 is on with Christy D on the way, and we're back to an open line tomorrow at Man in Line at 12 midday, high noon. WINT.